thousand million kalpas, having it to see and listen to remember and accept, I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words.
Good evening. I think often when we first hear about Zen practice, we have images of crazy wisdom teachers, you know, burning the Buddhas on the altar to stay warm on a cold night. These are traditional stories, right? And maybe you don't know these ones, but I think kind of iconoclastic images and stories we hear about Zen, that it's not even a religion, it's free from all of these kind of ceremonial trappings of religions, and it's about just being. Before I even got into Zen, I would hear phrases like, kind of slang phrases growing up in high school, like, just Zen it. Maybe this phrase isn't used anymore, but just Zen it means like, just do it. Like, stop thinking about it, just do it, do the next thing, just Zen it. these kind of feelings and thoughts about Zen, I think, often come to mind for people. And then we get here and there's doing things like, you know, chanting names of Buddha while mysteriously putting life into a wooden statue. And it seems like that's not what I came here for, maybe, we might think. I think many of us, myself included, were surprised to see this kind of traditional ritual kind of things in Zen practice. And there are practice places in America particularly where they've done away with a lot of this. And I think it's an interesting question, and I hope we have time to discuss today what you all think about the value or non-value of these types of events and forms and ceremonies. And what's the Zen spirit in doing these things? Do we actually believe in some kind of magical thing happening? There may be a fine line between faith, deep faith, and superstition. Maybe quite a fine line, right? one of the factors of mind, of deluded mind, to be relinquished in the early teachings of the Buddha at the first kind of level of awakening, the first like kind of major point of dropping off. One of the three factors to be relinquished, the first two being sense of an independent self, of like me as an independent person. And so we might feel like, yeah, that's the kind of thing that I think of when I think of Zen. And doubt is another one, doubt about the teachings and the way of practice leading to this insight into no independent self. But then the third is we could translated kind of loosely as superstition. Actually, superstition is relinquished. Literally, it's called, in Sanskrit, it would be Shila Rata Paramarsha, which is like grasping at sila, is precepts, you know, virtue practices, and vrata is like ritual observances. So actually grasping at precepts and ritual observances, particularly as the cause of liberation, the cause of freedom from suffering in this life, is to be relinquished. Isn't that interesting? And that it's, you know, one of these three main factors. You could, maybe if you're listing like hundreds of them, you throw it in there, but it's that significant. And so that's why this is, could be a tricky area, because this fine line between what's that, what's kind of holding on to or playing with, sometimes it's paramarsha, like kind of playing with ritual observances in order to create some like liberation. I think this is mainly why the Buddha taught it. It's like that this is the cause of liberation. And he's saying the point is more of these other two. Doubt about these fundamental teachings about selflessness and the Four Noble Truths and so on, and the teaching of no independent self, that's what's actually liberating us from bondage in the world of cyclic existence, bound up in our difficulties and graspings. And yet, maybe not so much in the Buddhist time, but even in the Buddhist time, in the early teachings, it looks like there was quite a bit of actually ritual elements in the Buddha's Sangha, much less than evolved over the centuries in other countries. And Japan, where the Zen tradition comes from, may be one of the most highly evolved ritualistic forms of Buddhism, including Zen. So what's the way to see this? That it's not like a superstitious belief, or not using it to think that we're actually going to gain some kind of liberation by doing a ceremony perfectly, something like that. And what's the way to even view something like, did we really like magically put some kind of life into Avalokiteshvara? Or is this just a ritual enactment? And one way to look at this is that everything, one of the Buddha's teachings is that the world and everything in it is created by mind and or intention. So if we put intention into something, that's actually creating a reality. And if you look around, particularly the human world, you know, we could get into the non-human world. Did our intention actually create the trees and rocks? And that might be a deeper discussion. But definitely looking around the street with all the houses and cars and human-made material things, we can see this whole world as we walk down the street is like a product of intention. And it's kind of amazing to actually like view the street as you walk down the street, as you know, maybe harder in the woods or something, but on a city street, this is all created by every little piece, by some intention. You know, the window trim and the mailbox flag, and like, you know, the people who built it and designed it was all the gear wheels of human intention working and creating such a world. So if we bring, and what an amazing thing that can happen in the material world, we see the effect. So if we bring that same kind of intention of mind that's so obviously powerful into something like a more invisible form of intention that's just intending to put life into a statue, it could have similar effects as creating a whole city, but it's just not as visible in the spiritual world. But that's a way to look at ritual expression, is it's like it's creating certain kind of space and effects and a more like mind effect in the world. And particularly, we're interested in wisdom and compassion. So the intention to invoke wisdom and compassion, enshrining the bodhisattva of great compassion, on a more mundane level, we could say it's just a reminder when we see it, when we walk in the room, it's just a reminder of the beauty of compassionate openness. And on a deeper level, the more intention we put into something like that, the more it affects our own, opens our own compassion. And a way to interact, now that she, Guan Yin, is enshrined on the altar, now how to interact with her to create new intentions. The traditional way is making offerings. So we have an incenser back there, and offerings are made every day. And just when you pass by, bowing is an offering. And as we enter and exit the zendo, bowing to the space is just a simple bow as we come in and out. It's kind of an offering. And if it's, especially if it's done with intention, it can just be like the mindless habit of, oh yeah, that's what we're supposed to do again. But we can put intention into it, that we're actually honoring wisdom and compassion as we bow in and out of such a room that's set up to invoke wisdom and compassion. And some, just to bring up some classical sources of teachings on making offerings, particularly in the Mahayana, the great vehicle of which Zen is a part, particularly from the Lotus Sutra, which is a text being studied these days at Santa Cruz and Monterey Zen centers. And one of the classic texts of Dogen Zenji, the Zen founder, his favorite sutra, you could say. And there's a section where the Buddha is saying, I'm about to reveal the complete, as yet to be revealed teaching. And and get ready for this, because it's going to be the most exalted and complete teaching that I've ever given, the Buddha is saying. And Shariputra is, you know, keeps begging him to give it, and he keeps saying how great it's going to be. And Shariputra goes, say it, world honored one. And then the Buddha says, well, since you've asked three times, how can I refuse you? Now listen carefully and I'll explain. And when he says this, immediately 5,000 disciples in the audience get up and leave. You may have heard this story. It's one of these classic sections of the Lotus Sutra. They got up, they did bow to the Buddha, and then they left. And this was because their deluded minds were obscuring them, and they were arrogant, utterly arrogant, that they had imagined themselves to have already attained and borne witness to what they had not actually attained. Therefore, they left. So the idea was that they were already these realized beings, and the Buddha had been teaching for many, many years. The sutra was taught at the end of Buddha's life. And so they thought, well, what do you mean? There's going to be something more? We're already set. So, like, we'll be going now. And maybe they thought, like, we just don't need to hear this. Let's go home. But the Buddha is saying, actually, they didn't even notice it, but there was this arrogance that they felt like they already understood, so they didn't need to hear anymore. And then the Buddha starts, for the ones who are left, the Buddha starts explaining how rare this teaching is, and about skillful means. It's a chapter on skillful means. And that only a Buddha, together with a Buddha, can understand this. And it's for this one great cause and condition that the Buddhas appear in the world. It's and the one great causal condition for Buddha's appearing in the world is to open a way to the Buddha's insight for beings, and demonstrate the Buddha's insight to living beings, and helping living beings apprehend things with the Buddha's insight, and so on. So basically to help others see. The Buddhas only appear to help beings who don't see clearly, how to see clearly. And then the Buddha teaches the one Buddha vehicle. There's one Buddha vehicle that I won't define, because the Buddha doesn't either at this point so clearly. You could say the whole rest of the sutra defines it, but it's not like a one sentence description. But then to express all of this in verse, he says a little bit more, but then he goes into this verse and talking about the Buddha's skillful means. And then the Buddha starts talking about making offerings after he's gone. And not only is it just like a good thing, and like it's kind of like it's nice and it makes you feel happy, but it's even more than that. Yeah. This is a photo of Vulture Peak where the Lotus Sutra was taught. It's kind of misty. So when a Buddha has passed away, if those who make offerings to the remains of a Buddha, in the stupas where their Buddha's remains are, all such beings have fulfilled the Buddha way. If anyone, for the Buddha's sake, designs and erects images carved with appropriate features, they have fulfilled the Buddha way. Strange. I think maybe a little strange. And the Buddha said, you know, supposedly saying this, you know, for eons after he's gone, about designing and erecting images carved with appropriate features, and just making them, they have fulfilled the Buddha way. Not just like it's good practice, but they fulfilled the Buddha way, like completed the practice. Some use the seven precious materials, or nickel, copper, and bronze, lead and tin, and the like, or iron, wood, or clay, or resin and lacquer, to make or adorn Buddha images. All such people have fulfilled the Buddha way. Some paint Buddha images of many colors and adorn them with 100 signs of good fortune. Whether done by themselves or by employing others, all have fulfilled the Buddha way. Even if little children at play use reeds, sticks, or brushes, or even their fingernails to draw images of Buddha, all such people, gradually gaining merit and developing their great compassion, have fulfilled the Buddha way. Just by transforming people into bodhisattvas, they have saved countless beings. So, does making these images transform people into bodhisattvas? Or if they have others perform music by beating drums, mokugyos, or blowing horns or conch shells, or playing pipes, flutes, lutes, harps, mandolins, cymbals, or gongs, producing fine sounds and presenting them as offerings, or if they joyfully praise and chant the Buddha's virtues in song, even with just a tiny sound, they have fulfilled the Buddha way.
Homage.
Homage. If anyone, even while distracted, this is getting good now.
Listen up.
If anyone, even while distracted, with even a single flower, makes an offering to a painted image, they will progressively see countless Buddhas. There are those who worship by prostrating themselves, some merely by putting their palms together, others only by raising a hand, and others only by a slight nod of the head. Homage to Buddha, let's all bow. Enough. All of these honoring images in various ways will progressively see countless Buddhas, fulfill the unexcelled way themselves, save countless beings everywhere, and enter into nirvana without residue, as a fire dies out when the firewood is all consumed. If anyone, even while distracted, enters a stupa or a hall and even once exclaims, "Homage to Buddha," they have fulfilled the Buddha way. People who have heard this Dharma from one of the Buddhas of the past while they were in the world or after their extinction have all fulfilled the Buddha way. So it goes on and on about making offerings to Buddha, and Dogen Zenji himself praising this sutra and other sutras about making offerings and how to build stupas and things like this. It's a chapter called, and the Shobo Genzo called, Making Offerings to All Buddhas. And he says, Dogen says, people become Buddhas by making offerings to Buddhas. So how do we understand this in a way that's not superstitious, is not, you know, is this about realizing the emptiness of the independent self that's truly the liberating trademark of Buddha Dharma? Is it actually that, what is that, what making offerings is? Or is it something else? If it's something else, then maybe it is kind of a sidetrack. So, or if it's even leading, if it's just, you know, leading up to some future goal in the future. Sometimes it is talked about this way, of like accumulating merit for the future. But Zen usually doesn't have that perspective. Usually it's an immediate, sudden practice that's completely all-encompassing. So is there a way to see doing ceremonies and rituals as not a means to an end, actually, but just as an end in itself? Just doing an activity with the intention, with a wholehearted intention. ritualized activities, some dictionary definitions say that ritual or ceremony is an action just performed formally with no like efficacy to produce some effect. That's one. I think sometimes rituals might be just the opposite. You know, ritual, a rain dance is to create rain for native peoples, for example. But a lot of other rituals seem to be done not to produce some effect, but actually just to do them. Like a dance, for example, is a kind of a ritual. Done not to get to the end of the dance, for example, but just to actually do it. I think other performing arts and music and so on could be seen as kind of ritual. A concert is kind of a ritual event, but it's not to produce some effect in the end. It's just to do it. So I would say that a Zen perspective on ritual could be like this too, that we just completely wholeheartedly do something just to do it. And how seriously do we take it? If we kind of, well, just like however it works out is fine, then is that really wholehearted? And yet if we take it too seriously, like, I can't believe the mistake happened and like that should never have happened, then we're in the grasping world and we're suffering because it didn't go well. So there's some middle way in it, just doing any activity. So that's a little bit about ritual, and we can discuss this further, but I just want to also bring up one classic Zen story about Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva that you've probably, many of you might have heard, but this is a especially auspicious occasion to bring up a story about Avalokiteshvara in the Zen tradition, the Bodhisattva of Great Compassion, this archetypal Bodhisattva that's often depicted as having many hands and eyes. And this is a story about the Dharma brothers Yun Yen and Dao Wu. And Dao Wu asks, what does the Bodhisattva of great compassion, Avalokiteshvara, do with all these hands and eyes? We could say if it's the image, the wooden image has literally 1,000 hands with an eye on each hand. But even this one here has 2 hands, and one of them is pouring the water of compassion, or holding the water of compassion, about to pour it. And what does she do with, actually? How does it work? How does great compassion function? How do the hands and eyes of compassion function? And Yunyan, does anyone know the story? This is the right order. One of them, I think it's Yunyan, says, it's like reaching back for a pillow at night. People know this story? Have you heard this story? Oh, and this is, for those who haven't heard, this is worth telling then, because this is the quintessential Zen view of compassion in the form of a Zen koan. So what does the Bodhisattva of great compassion do with all these hands and eyes? How does she function? And it's, you know, it could be talking about the image, but really it's about how does great compassion function in practice? And the answer is very strange answer. It's like reaching back for a pillow at night. And the image is just like we might imagine when you're half asleep and you're, sometimes it's translated as groping around for a pillow at night. Like you're half asleep and you notice that your head's off the pillow. You know this experience, like your head, you know, it's kind of uncomfortable, like you know, you're half asleep and you notice you're on the hard mattress and your neck's crooked. So it's like, you know, and you pull the pillow in without, in the dark, without opening your eyes. Can you picture that image? I mean, I think we all have that experience sometimes. That's how great compassion works. Groping around in the dark. We can't see where the pillow is. We're only half awake. We're not like total Buddha skillful means, like, I know exactly how to work it right now. This person needs a candy bar. You know, it's more like this person needs, like, I don't know. But it's like, I don't just say I don't know. It's like, actually, you know, reaching around and grabbing hold of something to create comfort. And the image is nice too, because it's compassion for ourself to pull the pillow up under our head, but compassion for others works the same way, to without knowing, in the dark, to grope around for something helpful and comforting, and basically without knowing what's going on. And then Daowu's, Yunyan's Dharma brother, says, I understand. And so he says, well, how do you understand? And he says, it's all over the body is hands and eyes. That's how I understand reaching back for a pillow at night. All over the body is hands and eyes. So instead of the first question was, you know, what does the Bodhisattva do with all these hands and eyes? Like reaching back for a pillow at night. But I understand that as all over the body is hands and eyes. In other words, we're just, our whole being, the whole surface of our being is responding. The hands and eyes is like seeing and responding. Great image, right? It's like, and literally that's how the image is portrayed, of like there's an eyeball on the palm of the hand. So like seeing what's needed and then being able to offer, help something. Very beautiful and unusual image to see the 1,000-armed Bodhisattva. And so his Dharma brother says, that's pretty good, all over the body's hands and eyes, but you only got 80%. It's 80% right, which is one of these classic Zen phrases. like 80%. And then Well, how would you say it then? And he says, throughout the body, his hands and eyes. That's maybe 100% answer. Not only all over the body, the surface of the body, how we seem to respond on the surface, but throughout the body, the entire, no inside and outside, no separation throughout this body and throughout the entire Dharma body that encompasses everything, hands and eyes, just seeing and responding, which is basically just openness. Or there's another way to look at compassion. It's not about like trying to figure out the best, most helpful thing to do. It's just being present and open, which is why Zazen is practice, our meditation practice, is a cultivation for compassion. It's learning openness to respond. And the eyes, and opening the eyes of compassion that observe sentient beings, Guanyin, which is a line from the Lotus Sutra in the Avalokiteshvara chapter, eyes of compassion observing sentient beings. And this is like just being present and seeing, literally seeing beings and being open to them so the beings are seen. Everybody wants to feel seen. And so literally, like, seen. We can, you know, look at each other and be seen, see and be seen, and that meet in that way. And compassion can function very simply and ordinarily in such a way. So, in just a couple minutes, if anyone has points to bring up about either how compassion functions and Guanyin Bodhisattva, or ritual and ceremony in Zen. Two huge topics, of course, but... Yes?
Like, during the ceremony, you reminded me of the line of the, you know, wooden man and the stone woman. Somehow enlivened. You know, as you were saying, you know, we now have a relationship with these images, and I think of other things, you know, like you know, pinnacles. I mean, I know I project a lot on beautiful vistas, but you know, certain stones or vistas, you just start having a relationship with, and whether that's breathing life or we're sharing some sort of communication. Are the pinnacles communicating with me when I notice them? Is it because they've called out to me? But all of a sudden, you know, I have a relationship with.
Yeah. In the deepest sense, it's like there. It must be the case that when we're open to something, it's open to us. In that, you know, we're interdependent in vast, inconceivable ways, and it affects other people too. Like when we put energy into anything, like I think of this garden back here too. It's like over decades, people have put so much energy into designing and evolving and beautifying and planting and taking care of the Zen Center garden here. And I had that feeling when I saw it, see it. I'm thinking especially when the first time I saw it, I felt the energy of life having been put into it through intention. And from people who are maybe long gone too. That's the beauty of a temple or something like this too, because it's all about putting life into things, and then we're impermanent, so we leave and something goes on and it's enlivened. I think if we were all to completely disappear and people just came into the empty place and tried to start something, it would feel like there was already something, some life here. And of course we have to keep, you know, if we were to leave for long enough, I think if there's no human energy being put into things, eventually they start to disintegrate. You go go into like an old ghost town or something, and you feel the ancient life there, but there's not much left. It wears off, so that's why we have to keep making offerings. It's not a one-time thing.
I think about the moment of the ritual rather than the outcome. I like today, I was really struck by, we've never stood that way yet. Ever in the Zendo. It was maybe and it'll probably be, like you said, the only time we ever do that, because how many statues are we going to put on that little shelf? This is probably it. So there it was, you know, and it was a moment where we just gathered. We gathered at the door. We've never gathered at the door before.
Occasionally we gather back here.
Yeah, I was just struck by that, you know, and it was so sweet. It felt so sweet. And just the thought of, I think, we're talking about keeping the doors open. Is that true?
Yeah.
Maybe that's a discussion.
I think we'll try that.
Mm-hmm. But the idea of, you know, stepping into the Zendo and seeing Avalokiteshvara and seeing, you know, Koban and Suzuki, it's like, oh, how friendly. That feels very friendly. So I was just struck as we were doing it, not the end, but the actual experience of intimacy.
Mm-hmm. And I think particularly the people who are here tonight, again, if we have, I think we'll try for a while, leaving the doors open, see how it goes. And as we, you know, people who are here, there's some energy we created, this particular group of people tonight, so we might have a different feeling for a while when we come in there, and that it affects the other people too. Our energy that went into this can, in inconceivable ways, I think, a lot of the time, it's inconceivable how it's affecting others. And we don't know. It could be bad. We've been having discussions like, maybe we shouldn't, you know, maybe it's too much Chinese writing, for example. It's maybe, it could be alienating to people. And that may be so. And maybe some people are like, it's too weird or something. But the intention, you know, we don't know what effect it has, but if the intention is like, may this be beneficial, may this inspire people somehow, that's all we have to go on, really, in the end. And then we can get feedback, too. They can, like, over and over, people can say, like, that's a horrible altar back there. Like, let's, can you guys take it down and change it around and put Big Bird. And then we'd have to, practice committee would meet and, okay, well, maybe like a small Big Bird. Yes, Dana.
Well, if you put the Big Bird back there, you should put Cookie Monster too.
Cookie Monster, yeah. Actually, a battery operated Cookie Monster that actually is like, you know, munching cookies during Kinhin or something, yeah.
There's a practice of buying those little roly-poly Dharma dolls.
Oh, Bodhidharma, yeah.
And they come with, they have no eyes.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And the practice is when you start a business or you start a venture or you're kind of have an intention for something, something like good health, you paint an eye on the Buddha, and then when whatever the wish or desire becomes fulfilled, then you paint the other eye. And I think a lot of businesses and families, they actually never get around to painting the other eye, because, you know, it's really not exactly like a gaining thing, but it's a practice. And when we did this tonight, I was thinking that practice is some modern version of this.
Yeah, it definitely could be derived from this ceremony. Yeah, interesting. Becomes like a kind of just like folk ritual.
Yeah, I mean, in some Japanese restaurants, you know, you go in and you see the little kitty with its, often there'll also be a Buddha who's kind of like a roly-poly type thing that has usually just one eye painted in.
One-eye means the intention wasn't completely fulfilled yet, or else they forgot.
Right. Exactly.
Fill in the eye, yeah. And another, just maybe just to close because it's about time, but that reminds me of another image. There was one essay by Nichiren I was reading about opening the eyes of Buddha statues, and he's the founder of this like Lotus Sutra school, basically. And he's saying a Buddha has these 32 marks in the traditional teachings. There's 32 marks of Buddha, like long physical marks. They're like long earlobes, wheel, spoked wheel marks on the feet. Very strange images in these sutras. They're like, where are these coming from? I think it was part of maybe pre-Buddhist Indian culture, like the marks of great people. And if you drew a picture, sometimes think if you followed all the instructions of the 32 marks, Buddha would look really strange. You know, like his arms are twice as long as his legs and all kinds of funny things. But it's a traditional thing, 32 marks, but they're physical marks. And then Nichiren saying, you can build, you can make a Buddha image with 31 marks, but the 32nd mark is the awesome voice of wisdom. It's like the Buddha's voice is one of the 32 marks, and you can't make that in a wooden image. And so his proposal was, and maybe this is what they would actually do in the Nichiren school, is the Lotus Sutra is the voice of Buddha. So you offer the Lotus Sutra during the eye-opening ceremony as the Buddha's voice. And he talks about if you offer like a, one of the early lesser vehicle sutras, whatever you call that, the Buddha image will be endowed with Shravaka qualities. You know, for people who know these different images, it's like the types of sutras that you offer put that type of life into the Buddha. And he says the Lotus Sutra makes a complete Buddha. Right, so he's kind of biased towards the Lotus Sutra. And I thought in Zen they don't, in the ceremony, in the manual for this ceremony, there's nothing about sutras. And I thought that's because Zen is the separate transmission outside the scriptures, outside the sutras. So we have 31 marks, but the 32nd mark of the awesome voice of Buddha and the Dharma that comes out of the Buddha that can't be physically marked, I thought, that's us doing the ceremony. That's the without any sutra, our life is the final mark that actually puts the life into the Buddha. So this particular Avalokiteshvara, this particular Bodhisattva of great compassion that we just opened her eyes, I kind of feel like she is now us. You know, we could say the whole wider Sangha, but particularly us who are here in the ceremony, her open compassion is ours. That's all she has to go on, is us.
Maybe the second painted eye is action already fulfilled, then.
There's three times we chant, right? And I didn't explain this, but it's the third eye. You start with the center, like a third eye, and then the right and the left. So we do the third eye is maybe like complete non-dual Buddha eye, and then regular old right and left eye is the intention, and then the fulfillment at the end. So,
but
yeah,
she,
that's nice.
She might be us, but we are her.
She is not us, we are her.
She might be us, but we are her.
She might be us, but we are her. Yeah. And that's our... May our intention fill her with compassionate life, and now may her intention fill us with compassionate life whenever we meet her in the dark, groping for a pillow. May all beings be filled with the great compassion of Avalokiteshvara, the regarder of the cries of the world. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.